Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the AEW Dynasty Review. We are the Dudley Boys of What Culture. I'm Adam Wilborn, joined by Michael Havlett and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's AEW Dynasty pay-per-view. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and YouTube, where we do daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review AEW Dynamite and AEW Collision, but also Raw, SmackDown, the show formerly known as NXT 2.0. Pay-per-views, premium live events, we have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week complete, including a quiz, of course, on Wrestle Culture. As I said, they're joined by Havlett and Sidgwick to review AEW Dynasty. Sidge, what a show this was.
The show was absolutely incredible. Not a new one. It's the biggest guarantee in professional wrestling. I saw the face of God multiple times. I was quite staggered, not only by the match, but how they followed the match by various other matches. It was a great old time. And it's one of those where you think, should I hold on to this feeling or judge the weekly TV case by case? Had a bit of an existential crisis of, maybe I'm being too harsh week to week if it delivers this, but then is it the problem of one doesn't necessarily inform the other? All I know is that I will be well excited on Wednesday night ahead of Dynamite. The show was just utterly fantastic, I still think that if they're going to do near-monthly pay-per-views like this, on top of Collision, it's not going to help the problems. There is an abundance of AEW. At its best, I mean, it's just unparalleled. Mm-hmm. Unparalleled, potentially throughout pro wrestling history. But my God, there was at least one or two matches where I'm thinking, just get to the next one. Less is more, but after 5 years of AEW, you can never, ever get that.
Yeah, this is unreal. This is where the best wrestle. This was a pay-per-view to kind of the first one that was going to have that as their signature going forward, and it served its purpose straight away. Said this after the Helwani thing, don't be obsessed with proving CM Punk wrong, prove him right. If you are just a billionaire that wants to have six-star matches, be a billionaire with six-star matches, because there is nothing wrong in that, because it won't happen over here. Turns out they proved him wrong and right, because by airing the footage, Jack Perry is as over as he's ever been, so you got both. This is, I think, what AEW should like aim for all the time when we are sometimes criticised for our own criticisms of AEW. Sidge especially more than me, because I think in general, like, people assume that there's always just going to be this blanket like praise, and there's not. Like, that's never how any of us have done it. Ultimately, when we talk about, when we assess a really great storyline development on Dynamite, such as the formation of the new elite with Okada and the Young Bucks, we say this is what we talk about. We talk about peak AEW in terms of the ceiling of in-ring, the match on this show, and there's like others that came really close, by the way, but the match on this show that we're going to talk about later is the ceiling we talk about. Aim for that.
Yeah.
Shoot for that, because there is not a wrestling promotion in the world that can do it like AEW.
Lots to get into. Some phenomenal matches across this card, and Chris Jericho was on it as well.
Unfortunately,
we won't talk much about the pre-show. Bullet Club Gold are now the unified trios champions, but whew, thank goodness Billy Gunn was protected in that finish. Let's start at the beginning of the show, Sidge, because it was a match that you and I were a little bit concerned about in terms of placement on the card and how it's going to be received when compared to, say, Ospreay and Danielson. Jericho wasn't opening the show, thankfully. It was Kazuchika Okada and Pac, and what a standard to set from the start of this show for the AEW Continental Championship.
I would not merely describe this match as incredible. I genuinely think you don't like wrestling if you don't like this. It was criticism-proof without ever feeling safe or like they were striving for a great match. I mean, everyone strives for a great match. It's how you obscure that. It's how you don't make it feel self-conscious or desperate or like you must do this to get this chant or whatever. This was so remarkably self-assured in the pacing. It was impossible not to like this. If you like pro wrestling, you would be inclined to like this match. And I dare I say it, if you criticize it in any way, I think you're operating in bad faith. I think for what they went for what people claim to like about pro wrestling and for what the core ideals of the art and the medium are, what was wrong with it? What could you possibly pick fault at? The selling throughout by Pac was incredible. The pacing was just, everything made sense when it happened. It never felt rushed. It never felt grabby. It never felt like they were just spamming finishes mm-hmm. or kickouts just to get cheap pops. It was anti-cheap, anti-grabby, anti-tropey. And even during the slow bits, and it was really self-assured, like almost methodical in its mm-hmm. pacing, I was locked at that screen. And again, I'm looking at the flaws and I see none. And I'm looking at the features and I see everything. Pac selling was incredible. This was the ultimate establishing of the Kazuchika Okada match. Because you got a little bit, well, lots of the character in the Kingston match, but this is him putting it all together and delivering that standard classic. I mean, what a ridiculous two things to put together. But that's the standard at which Okada operates. The standard classic, the expected, I'll give us a classic match, I'll give us an excellent match, and you got it. He wrestled like the most cocky, confident, assured man on the face of the planet. That is the Okada magic. That is how he continues years deep, well over a decade, into his career of appearing like the final boss. I know The Rock's catchphrase is that, but in terms of the guy who, if you can possibly beat him, you are made. That's the perfect Okada character. He really fleshed it out and properly established it in AEW. And he's had his first iconic in-ring moment that will get gift, I suspect, forevermore if someone has a bad take on X when he goes through the Rainmaker pose and just does that. I just howled with laughter. I popped. And the good thing, or the great thing, of the many great things about this match is that Pac, selling and bumping are different. He sold majestically throughout. But his bumping here, like, how many times have you seen it in Okada draping DDT off a guardrail in the first 10 minutes of every single match he's done since 2012? The way Pac sold it, it just felt all over again that Okada's a killer who you simply can't beat. The way he jammed his neck, that trademark signature Pac bump is absolutely unreal. And again, going on that understated, you can't pick fault with this. It was just not grabby at all. The Rainmaker being a one-and-done thing all over again. The amount of times that's been kicked out of in New Japan, it was still effective, but it had lost some of the magic. That's back. I think they've done such a good, subtle job of rebuilding Okada, like making those, it's like, smells like Teen Spirit. You hear it so often that you no longer recognize it as a classic song. You go 5 years without it, and it just hits all the same. That's kind of the principle they've been operating on with Okada with these slower matches, giving you tiny little bursts in these trios. And the byproduct now, the net result is, the Rainmaker's the best, most convincing finish in wrestling all over again. And the good thing, or the great thing about the pacing, is that towards the final stretch or when you were in it, the amount of times Pac just caught him with a roll-up, at no point do you forget just how much he'd gone through in the war, but you thought he was going to win because he was just such a clever, strategic wrestler picking his spots. And Okada's the absolute best at 2.999 kickouts. And he never kicked out the Black Arrow. It was just so assured. This is absolutely liquid professional wrestling.
I saw, I think it was Denise Salcedo, or someone posted a clip, fan footage of the Black Arrow with him getting the knees up. And yeah, Pac just ate the knees.
He just looks like he's chipped his tooth and broken his neck at the exact same time. And he wasn't just underneath the whole time. He just sprinkled his spectacular high flying just at the perfect moments throughout. There's a time when he did the moonsault off the springboard top rope, and it just felt like it glitched because it was so fast and in your face. This was just absolutely incredible in terms of pacing, selling, even drama. There was one result here.
Yes.
How many times did you think, oh, I'd get it over? Not once. Not once.
Second longest match on the card as well.
Never felt it.
No.
It was the exact right match to go on first. It's the way it should be, but then often we see in wrestling, things don't play out the way they should be. They play out to certain wrestlers' whims or needs or politics or whatever. We talked about this match as the perfect opener because there was always going to be at least one more match that you would want to separate as far from it as possible that we, you know, we'll talk about later. And I echo everything Sid just said there. It was such a great night for Okada, but I just want to speak briefly on Pac. Seeing him work, like, almost as, like, a bleeding heart babyface version of the Bastard was yet another brand new Pac. Mm. I've seen him work as a babyface in social clubs in Gateshead, but I've seen him do it for WWE as Neville, you know? And then I've seen him be a kind of indifferent fit. He's worked with babyfaces, but he's not necessarily been a good guy. Here, he was everything. This was like the complete, this was like the final version of Pac the wrestler. If you wanted to, I don't never know of his exact situation, but if he was, say, committed to being on television every single week and you wanted to make him your world champion, it's this one.
Yeah.
This is the Pac because you would back him. There's nothing he can't do. He looks like a monster. He growls like a supervillain. And yet there are points at this match where you're reaching out through the screen trying out and you're like, wow, this is perfect Pac. Thank you for this. In terms of Okada, I know it's only a few weeks in, but if you really stack up what we've had from Kazuchika Okada and AEW and use this match as a topper, it's been like 2 months. What can't he do? Now, we said that about Will Ospreay relentlessly since he's arrived. He's world champion elect and all that sort of stuff. It's not some sort of hot take to say so's Kazuchika Okada, but there was a sense that when he was still in New Japan and there was no longer that need or that thirst to watch him anymore, or the concerns over could some of the more lackadaisical Okada performances like appear in AEW, could the matches be agented like a lot of those latter day New Japan ones, and then all of a sudden you're not getting the magic, you're getting a lot of the boring stuff. He's eliminated that from his game, and it might just be a now thing because he's not daft. He wants to make this best possible impression, but he appears to have eliminated that from his game entirely. We've seen great TV squashes. We've seen great TV matches in the likes of Kingston. We've now seen the first proper pay-per-view singles Okada match, and it was perfect. Really, a flawless bit of business. He's carrying a belt that he's instantly elevated, which is something else Kazuchika Okada does. He's another guy who is a month in and kind of final form. Like, I would back him to win the world title just as quickly as I would Will Ospreay, and it can only be one.
Yeah.
And that's not to neg the person that wins at the end of the show, by the way, but just this is what we're dealing with now. This is the ceiling. This is the level. And I think on a night when Will Ospreay and Bryan Danielson told you that this is the highest bar, Okada and Pac were like right up there with them. 2-on-1 show. That's like a remarkable performance, like all things considered. And we're still only scratching the surface of the Okada run. He's just like a loof dickhead heel farting about with the Young Bucks on television. And then this is on pay-per-view. In these matches where, as long as he's got that continental title, that can be minimal bollocks. Like, he went to the eyes. He's cheating now a little bit. He's not playing super fair, but he cannot benefit from run-ins, really.
Yeah.
So you're going to get more of these as long as he's got that belt. That's this nice established thing. He's definitely going to keep it till this year's Continental Classic. He's gone into G1s as champion in New Japan, and they're better for it. Mm. I want him to hold this belt through to December.
Yes.
Let's move on to the trios match. It was House of Black, Malakai Black, Roddy King, and Buddy Matthews taking on Adam Copeland, Eddie Kingston, and Mark Briscoe.
I think this went about 2 or 3 minutes too long. Truthfully, there was a point wherein I'm just watching moves with a Z and I'm a bit desensitized to them. And then we got the finish. This was accelerating and building at such a wonderful pace, and you were in such a great mood from the opener. And then it went 17 minutes, I think. 14. A little bit tighter. And this would have been perfect for its spot on the card. But that's the cynical negative take. The good take, the earnest take, the one I most believe in, is the fact that this was just tremendous. And really, the whole time, the House of Black should have held these titles. I know it's easy to say, given how it's unfolded. And the Acclaimed were really over once upon a time. But my God, they are just such a great team in the true sense of the word. They are so great. Like, each member has perfect synergy with the next, and they build these matches, and these matches flow in such an incredible way that when you are watching them, they just feel like this invincible team. What gatekeepers they would have been, having held the title for like well over a year. It could have been the making of a young group like a Top Flight and an Action Andretti. I was watching this match thinking what could have been.
A bunch of Gunthers.
Mm-hmm. And it's just the body language, and I talk about this all the time, the body language, the way they build their offense, the way they just feel like you cannot get near them. Like, best articulated when Buddy Matthews just blitzes Mark Briscoe in the face with that pump knee, and then he flies off the apron straight into the waiting arms of Brody King, who just smashes him headfirst against the barricade with the Death Valley driver. It's like a perfect ecosystem of brilliant teamwork. And the byproduct of that is when it starts to break down, and the baby faces band together and get a little bit of offense against them, you look at them and you think they're world beaters because they're going against this unbelievable unit. It did get a bit much, but then you got the finish, and what a political thing that is to explore. Malakai Black in a singles title match. Let's see how that goes. Okay, let's go. But there was a lovely bit as well where Kingston kind of slipped, I think. But he's Eddie Kingston. He's eternally beloved. It almost makes sense for him to mess up. It's like endearing almost when it kind of gets sloppy in a Kingston match. 2 minutes. But it's that less is more thing.
Yeah.
You'll never, ever get it with AEW. It'll never get lean. It's the problem. This is a 9.5 out of 10 pay-per-view. And there's rarely, as I don't think there's ever been a 10 in history, ever, on any promotion. They continually hit 9.5s. But the standard we talk about is like, the 10's there if you just removed a bit.
Mm. The big takeaway for me from this was, like, I'd be lying if I said I was hugely invested in the stakes. And I think that's where we are critical of the weekly TV show. Because my gut feeling after watching this was, if this was built well on television, this is the best pay-per-view I've ever seen. But one too many matches, I found there was like a certain emotional detachment, and then the longer they went, the worse that got. And this was an example of that. I just simply was never... I love this team of babyfaces, but I was never that arsed about them fighting the House of Black. I'm more interested in Malakai Black and Adam Copeland coming out the back of it. So again, not a wasted time by any means. And if anything, if this is a match to build that singles match, it's not a bad one. But it's, you know, like a nice collision main event or something on the top of the hour on Dynamite. Something like that, rather than on this pay-per-view where it was unnecessary. Just, I mentioned this after the latest Cope Open match. There should be a little thing in one of Tony Khan's spreadsheets where if Adam Copeland has interacted with the wrestler before, they're no longer allowed to interact with him again. Because I feed off his excitement being around new people. It's infectious. He's one of my low-key favourite wrestlers to watch at the moment, as long as he's on screen with somebody he's not really been on screen. Mm. I'll count Malakai Black as a singles as another new one, because I think people really wanted that when they were both spooky characters in WWE. Yeah. There is so many wrestlers he's never interacted with, and that's awesome because he clearly loves it. Whether or not it's a bit of his first opportunity to be a true locker room leader in the same way that like Jericho was in 2019, when like you've got your WWE historically just doesn't give certain chances to certain people, and he's taking a lot of pride in that. I don't know, but you can see it. It's radiating from him that like the stuff there's moves he's taking that you think, would I have been arsed if he'd have taken that off like a Randy Orton or something? Probably not.
No.
But like his energy that he's bringing to these matches at the moment, like considering that he's with Briscoe, just one of our like favorite baby faces, Eddie Kingston, this internally beloved figure. I think he kind of stole it on the babyface side, Copeland, for me. And I genuinely think he should be down as a proper success story. It's going well.
There was a very short match on this card. It was Willow Nightingale challenging Julia Hart for the TBS Championship. You can understand that when we heard about Julia Hart's shoulder injury going into this match.
By all accounts, had to bite through it.
Yeah, so fair play on that one. Willow Nightingale is your new TBS champion. And she knows who her next challenge is going to be, because Mercedes and Matt A immediately rocked up and tried to steal the limelight from her.
I'm in two minds about this whole thing. But I'll talk briefly about the post-match and then probably even more briefly about the match, because there was nothing to it. It's impossible to determine whether this Mercedes Moné and Jennifer Pepperman collab...
I don't know if we're going to get in trouble.
Calm down. Calm down. Whether they're leaning into it, they've looked at the temperature and realised that we're not going to be able to become a babyface at the expense of Willow Nightingale, or whether, as has kind of been the trend so far, they just continue to be oblivious and Tony Khan, faced in a delicate political situation with a superstar, just doesn't really know which way it's going or wants it to go. It's all very odd. We'll see. Las Vegas is going to be molten either way. So whatever works. Mm-hmm. The match was a formality. It was a lively nothing match where if I was to go through the viewers or the listeners, say this move happened, then it was countered by this move was attempted, then there was a counter, and I just said you'd miss nothing from the experience because it was kind of just there, but it was lively enough and people enjoyed it and it delivered an emphatic result. Bit of a shame with Willow because instantly you know that whether heel, babyface, whatever money is winning a double or nothing. Yeah. This wasn't the big hard-fought struggle or the climax of an epic chase. It was snake bit in the title win, but she's so inordinately likable that you just were happy for her nonetheless.
I mock the... Yeah, nothing else about the match, really. I mock the house rules because I think it's dumb. But I didn't actually mind the application of it here. Willow Nightingale, the babyface, wanting a fair fight, and Chris Statlander, somebody we know the heel turn is on the cards, being a little bit aggrieved that she was left out of that decision. Mm. Like, that's that justifiable annoyance from Chris Statlander when it's probably... Well, it's definitely her behind the attack on Mercedes Moné. It'll probably factor into the finish, I guess. Like, that relationship will break down between Statlander and Willow. So that's quite nice. Actually, that's a nice detail. Ostensibly, it was to get rid of Sky Blue and any chance of any other, like, sort of interference, but you've built that on the side again. I don't know. It makes me want to praise that they're, like, telling maybe five women's stories at once.
Yeah.
Like, they do keep doing that. Like, some are more successful than others, but they're typically, these matches have other matches spinning off them, and they've never really done that. There's actual thought into the character development, which I quite like.
Another match where a wrestler maybe overshadowed the result was Roderick Strong versus Kyle O'Reilly, international championship, with Adam Cole arriving afterwards and climbing out of his wheelchair, which was great to see.
I really enjoyed this Roderick Strong versus Kyle O'Reilly match. And it didn't suffer in the way that I thought it would. When Paco Nakata was as class as it was, and there was the sense that the building was hot and people were in the mood for great action and they knew what they still had to come, I kind of felt like this would be the victim. This was going to be the one that's... And it did go a little bit...
There wasn't much heat.
No, it still went a little bit long, match times, excess, all that sort of stuff. But I think by the end, they did get there. And although nobody had bought Kyle O'Reilly as winning, it's just great to see these two working together because they've just got this, like, timeless chemistry. Mm. Kyle O'Reilly's selling of Roderick Strong as a total kicker is one of the best, and probably he doesn't get enough credit for it because he's awesome at getting his ass kicked anyway. But Strong's offense really suits a guy that sells the way that Kyle O'Reilly does. This was the match, ultimately, realistically, to have Adam Cole do the rise out of his chair return, because obviously he's got all the history with O'Reilly as well. The thing I wanted to mention was this. I had no idea of this until I saw it online today. The Wardlow car accident deal. So have you seen
this? He moved about gingerly.
Yeah. And he said there was some sort of message he put where, like, the devil can't catch me or something like that. So he's almost referencing that, like, well, we can all see that Cole's giving you the death stare, but Wardlow, is he at long last a bit too smart to be caught out like this and he'll catch Cole first or something? I think I'm the last guy that gives a toss. But, like, the fact that, like, you're now going to Cole and Wardlow when MJF's eventual return looms, I don't think is bad. I think these characters are all knitted together in AEW history, and I think it's the direction to go.
Yeah. This match was the best, most well-worked, ice-cold match that followed by the finish I can recall in quite some time. Like, some of the fierce technical struggle here was just sublime, and I enjoyed watching it in my living room in a detached bubble. But I'd be lying if I didn't think when I was watching it, oh, please, they're trying. Give them something a bit more.
O'Reilly puts himself on, like, a hinge for backbreakers, doesn't he? Because
he's got that top turnbuckle backbreaker variation. That was great. And they've got this, well, they've had for years and years. So maybe they're drawing upon it too often by pairing them constantly, Roderick Strong with Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly with Roderick Strong. This, like, symbiotic relationship throughout pro wrestling, and maybe people are a little bit, I mean, if people are tired of the elite in All Elite Wrestling being together constantly, what would an AEW fan think of Undisputed Era lore just continuing to haunt them and getting tethered together their entire careers? Maybe that accounted for a pretty flat atmosphere. Maybe the fact that they might as well have put it on Honor Club if it was on Battle of the Belts, the angle that built the match. And maybe the fact that Kyle O'Reilly largely has been doing stuff on Collision. I know it does well for the slot, but it doesn't do Dynamite numbers.
Yeah.
And maybe some of these AEW fans in St. Louis were like, well, I don't really watch Collision, so I'm not that invested in this match.
And they were great crowd throughout the night.
They were, but it took them ages to get going on this one. But some of the work was just a total joy. That's the bad byproduct of having them paired together forever. It's that when you see them in the ring, yet again, either against each other or on the same side, it's just deeply familiar and they are no longer as relevant. They're probably less relevant than they've ever been, even though they've had a bigger audience possibly than ever. But in the same breath, their work together is utterly sublime. They were doing these counters where they've got such an intuitive knowledge of what they are even going to begin to attempt, counter that immediately. The momentum shifts were incredible. They were about, like, in one sequence, Kyle O'Reilly was about to do, like, a guillotine choke, and just as he motioned to even try, backbreaker, like, you're just in that position to do it. If this had heat, this would have been the sleeper hit of the entire night. The actual work, or at least the actual wrestling, was sublime, different level. Some of it was so gruesome, like a proper squelcher, but the fans just weren't into it that much, and you know, that's what atmospheres need. I mean, that's why you need to tell stories. Is it not?
Yeah.
You can't do this on Collision. That was my big takeaway is if you want to get a reaction to a match on pay-per-view, you damn sure better build at least half of it on Dynamite.
This was neither I'm the better wrestler nor a blood feud, was it, as well? Like, they started off as a bit of a blood feud. Come and join us. No, I'm going to kick your ass. And then it never really developed into that real blood.
That built Kyle enough. Yeah. Like, yeah, it was so neither Naut nor Summick, but also somehow awesome at the same time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Well worth checking out Michael Sidgwick's brilliant ups and downs article
transcript of this
about the show at whatculture.com. Heaps praise on so many things, all the ups and just the one down. Speaking of which, Chris Jericho versus Hook for the FTW championship. This was the only blot on the copybook, I think it's fair to say.
The only major one. As I said, there were some matches that didn't quite get the heat that I would have liked.
But yeah.
Main event was kind of flawed, we'll get to it. But ultimately a big success. You could have shaved a couple of minutes off a lot of matches. It's the AEW thing. The 9.5, could have been a 10. Merely a 9.5 out of 10.
We're not talking runtime, by the way. People get their nicks and a twist over this.
Sequencing.
It's sequencing and pacing and all those sort of things.
And what matches you put in what order and all the rest of it. This was just a... thing is, I was going to say it's an abomination. There's been way worse matches.
Oh, yeah.
in the history of pro wrestling on pay-per-view. I contend...
This month.
Yeah.
We've seen a worse Jericho one.
Yeah, I've seen a worse Jericho one match in person. But it's all about vibes and star power and presentation. And my God, this is 17 minutes, right? For seven of those minutes, if you would have move for move laid out this match when Chris Jericho was over, when he was Le Champion, when he was stooging his arse off to genuinely hilarious effect, this would have been move for move doing the exact same things in the exact same order in which they did them. Incredibly cathartic. That bump that Jericho took sideways on his neck from that suplex off the apron was genuinely incredible. No one cared. Do not confuse this atmosphere or this heat for anything resembling effective heat. Some people, will go unmentioned, have got this wrong. There can be no perfect example or illustration of go-away heat when the fans in the building are literally chanting, go away, go away, go away, please retire. And if Jericho actually heeded that advice and went away, good luck touring with Fozzy, because they also chanted Fozzy sucks.
Yeah.
At this point, as it was made abundantly clear, people do not want Chris Jericho to do anything. Even when he's taken one of the genuinely most awesome sick bumps of his career, no one gives a toss. Mm. And the thing is, for 7 minutes, this was morbidly entertaining, and there could have been something on the worst, most inadvertent level imaginable, a little bit of joy, a little bit of entertainment, a little bit of intrigue, a bit of schadenfreude, and even flush that down the friggin' toilet because it went 17 friggin' interminable minutes. This did nothing for Hook. Chris Jericho at this point, how many... I'm so bored of saying go away. They had fun with it. That's the thing. People actually had fun with the worst part of Chris Jericho, i.e. the fact that he still exists. For 7 minutes of a... 17 minutes is... 17 minutes is ages. It is absolutely ages. And what's worse about it is that, like, Chris Jericho's kind of got that thing where if you ever listen to Talkers Jericho, I will guest dependent if I want to hear the story of Prince Nana. Check that episode out, by the way. It's really good. And Prince Nana comes off as the best guy. It's like, this is the third time. You know, he's like a big plagiarist. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's probably too strong. You know, I just liberally draws inspiration and is outward about that. He'll say when he debuted in the Fed in 1999, the whole arms outstretched back to the audience for several minutes on end. You saw Michael Jackson do it when he went to see him in Paris, I think it was. I'll steal that for my bit. He's like, oh, this movie, that'll inspire me. You'll say it outright. Mm. It's like he's forgotten that he's done the Lesnar SummerSlam 2014 match three times. He did it against Wardlow in 2021 as part of the Labours of Jericho. He did it against Hook 3 or 4 weeks ago. Then he's done it again, twice the length, with a few table spots there. Not only was it unwanted, even if this was good, people hate Jericho and he needs to go away. Even if it was good, no one wanted this. It was the third Suplex City match he's done.
Yeah.
It's people have been bored of the spam finisher Lesnar formula before Brock Lesnar has become persona non grata. Why are you doing Lesnar matches in 2024? The guy who used to pride himself as being on the pulse is so far detached from it. And what's worse is that they decide the last thing I want to do or ever see is Chris Jericho full stop. Chris Jericho melodrama. Don't make me hurt you, man. I don't want to hurt you. What do you want from him?
Yeah.
Doesn't want to be your mate. He's made that abundantly clear.
That made no sense in the context of this specific match either.
Which itself made no real sense.
Setting up an FTW title match. I don't want to hit you really hard with all these weapons that we're definitely going to use. Mm. Like, and take your belt that is basically a family heirloom rather than a title. And I want that. I don't want to hurt you, but I want that.
Fans popped when Taz stood up. They thought he was going to get involved.
Taz has got aura and he always will. Like,
this is pathetic. I'm so bored of it, man. At what point is Tony Khan going to have to intervene here? I'm dead serious. This can't go on. You get a brutal reminder that a key player who was going to be one of the few weekly fixtures in this vastly rotating cast, which I know we're on a high from Dynasty other than this match. It's still a big concern in AEW for a lot of fans. At what point is he going to have a big boy conversation and say, I can't put you on this show? The worst thing is as well with WWE being as hot as it is, these two promotions are inextricably linked, whether you like the tribalism or not.
Yeah.
Right, I'll let you talk in a minute. I'm sorry. I need a rant.
Tony Khan does.
Tony Khan believes it as well. Tony Khan has said it. These promotions are absolutely inextricably linked. I didn't want the discourse to go this way. It has. We're stuck here. And Tony Khan loves it and endorses it. AEW came out in 2019. And think of what WWE looked like in 2019. 5 years later, in the Jericho Vortex exclusively, AEW is now the shows that the fans hijack because they resent it and hate it. That can't be.
Yeah.
That's not right. Like, philosophically, for why the company exists or what it strives to do, you can't have that. You have to tell them to go. Yeah, it's not. If it was like a fun part of the show, like people like the Codyverse was a proper hijack, but it was intriguing. It was different for AEW.
He's on fire.
And he's on fire. Jericho doesn't have the matches to bail him out. Ishii, Roderick Strong, Quake by the Lake, Moxley. All completely dead. He's washed. It's some, like, if this was fun and people really enjoyed it, it's one thing to have as this freak show on your show. After 50% of the runtime, everyone's like, right, okay, I'm not even having fun spoiling this guy's party. And the thing is, Chris Jericho was beyond a joke. People still tried to have a punchline at his expense up to a point, and then it was like, oh, please go away.
This is it, right? We're sort of touching this on Dynamite. I just feel like a bit depressed. That's not the right word, but like I just feel a sense, an air of depression around the Chris Jericho thing, and I don't look forward to having a conversation. The dunks are dated and passe. There's no dunks left to have on Chris Jericho. Like, look, he's dunking on himself going out there every week, you know? One of the things that made WWE as bleak as it was for all of those years, and we used to say this all the time, was that you weren't allowed to think or feel anything for the characters because ultimately they were performing for an audience of one. So is Chris Jericho. The problem is the one is Chris Jericho. We've gone from the man in the back being the audience of one to the rest of themselves. I don't know what's worse, because at least like when the audience of one was Vince McMahon, by accident, he might push some wrestlers that you enjoy watching. Chris Jericho's audience of one is Chris Jericho, who's the belt for. You didn't want a second Hook match, let alone a third one if they have to exchange his back. I think he's going to smash that belt with his bat. I think that bat, like Floyd factoring in at the finish, I think it's just going to destroy that belt, and it's going to be seen as like, how could you do this to the family, that sort of whatever, you know. It theoretically has to lead to a third match. Who wants that? Nobody wanted the second. Nobody wanted the tag team. Nobody wanted any version.
Nobody
of
wants Chris Jericho.
No, other than Chris Jericho. Yeah. The audience of one continues to get his way, and it's not even the booker. And I don't know a way out of that. Like, and you can't even say, oh, the Vortex, what a cell phone. They might flog a couple of T-shirts out of it, so the joke continues to be on us. You know?
At some point, one of two things needs to happen. One of them's, and both of them seem equally unlikable. Tony Khan has to be less feckless. When have we ever seen that? Very rare occasions. I'm absolutely stunned he didn't re-sign Matt Hardy. So maybe there's a glimmer of hope there. Or Chris Jericho needs to go away. Hey, I mean, it's untenable.
Mm.
It's drastically ruining the vibe of the product.
There's more chance of him having a new T-shirt that says "Go Away Heat" or something than there is of him actually following the request.
I said he's going to rebrand as the Workaholic, and the heat would be that he's going to threaten to go away and then do a run-in later in the show. He's leaning in so far that he's no longer on his feet.
Mm.
It's his legacy. It's not my legacy. It's his legacy he's ruining here.
The quality, the actual quality of meta textual stuff in wrestling is overstated, isn't it?
Yes.
Very few wrestlers ever actually get it right. It's not a shock to suggest Chris Jericho is not getting meta textuality right.
Let's move on and talk about the AEW Women's World Championship match. Thunder Rosa challenging Timeless Toni Storm for the title.
Show's goated from here, by the way.
Yeah. For the title she never lost. I love these two working together.
This is fantastic. This is absolutely fantastic. There was the danger that, because I suspect a real tension exists between these two women, Toni Storm might as well have said it. I mean, she could not have been laying on the subtext any thicker, what, 2 years ago, when she all but said, in her mind, I'm not saying who's right or wrong,
no,
but I'm saying Toni Storm said, oh, She all but said, I don't believe the title. I don't believe the injury was as severe enough as Thunder Rosa claimed.
She should have done business. Interim champion, didn't she?
Hated the interim champion. Has very much insinuated that Thunder Rosa either should have powered through or was capable of powering through. Not for me to say, and I would never suggest it one way or the other. But that tension existed, and there's always the danger that there could be a complete lack of cooperation. One might sandbag the other. They would rather have a bad match than make their opponent look good. These petty politics that we see in pro wrestling, they seem to channel, if this tension still exists, I reckon it does, in the perfect possible way. Mm. This felt almost, I can't speak for the wrestlers involved, this felt, from my subjective individual vantage point, that this was as cathartic for them to wrestle. Mm. They just enjoyed laying it in. And my God, they did. It was fantastic. As it was for the audience. And what a great two birds, one stone thing. The rap on Toni Storm, justified in my view, is that the gimmick weighs down the in-ring work and she's never once got the balance. Well, she did last night. And the rap on Thunder Rosa is that she's kind of washed and she is not the same wrestler she was in 2021. What a night for her. She looked crisp, ferocious at various points, totally dialed in, totally motivated. Some of the angles from the released Germans was great. And speaking of meta stuff, they really played when she crumpled with agony when she was had the back worked over. Like this added, incorporated a real-life bit of backstory for those people who are in the know. And if you're a floating voter fan, you just watched two really on-form pro wrestlers kick seven bells of crap out of each other. Had a really, really good time with this.
Yeah, when Thunder Rosa never, in her last run with AEW, when she wasn't necessarily always given the promo time, or even often like the character development, the one thing she always had was the matches. And then in coming back, that to me was the one thing that felt like it had deserted her a little bit. And you know, we allow for rust and all of these sort of things. And, you know, people might know Thunder Rosa's been on the channel with us. There might be some bias attached here, but you also want to say, you're Thunder Rosa. Just get there.
Yeah.
And here it was, watching her get there last night in the strongest match since she's returned and probably one of the strongest matches she's had in AEW.
Full stop, eh?
It's just thrilling to see, honestly. I'm with Sige, like that electricity between the two of them. There is this thing in wrestling where, because it's cooperative, if you can't work together, you're not going to get the response from the crowd, and then you're both going to blame each other for it. Whereas if you can, and you get that heat that this match generated from a crowd that wanted to give it
to them. This crowd loved this as well.
Loved it. That must have been such a feeling in there. It's like, well, the one thing that divides us is going to be what brings us together. Now let's go. And like, it just, you could feel it as well. Mm. Toni Storm, I don't disagree with Sige's point that she finally found the character to match the rest.
You know what? The Izumi match was great, so
I think she switched it off a bit. I just think she switched off. And I like Timeless Toni Storm, but I think she toned the bollocks down a little bit. This was a little bit closer to that, like, Divisions Ace run she had in, like, 2022, whatever it was. It got, and again, that might
you
be driven
just
by
one. Just no one's asking for the gimmick in the ring, and maybe she's finally realised this. Mm.
I don't know if it was just because they both knew there was a certain expectation here and they wanted to surpass it or whatever it was. Quite like the, I don't know if this is going to be a permanent choice, but I actually quite like the aesthetic change for Rosa as well.
Yeah.
Like, obviously it plays into the direct story they had with the makeup and the face paint being taken off and stuff, but like, just a small tweak like that can go quite a long way, because she's going to go off in a different direction now. It's feeling like a fresh coat of paint, oddly enough, by taking some of it off. I'd like, that's a little bit of character development.
And then she can always, for the special matches, bring it back.
Yeah, massive pop, isn't it, when it does?
Because it's such a great look.
Yeah.
Always was. Now, there was just such a competitive edge to this match that I thought was great.
The vibes were right, weren't they?
Yeah.
Really, really good.
Nailed it.
Here we are, Sige. Will Ospreay versus Bryan Danielson. The floor's yours, mate.
One of the best matches I've ever seen. Completely lived up to the hype. This was honestly right. I'm watching this match. It's almost too good to start with. What I mean by that, right, is that from the days of Rob Van Dam and Jerry Lynn doing the cagey ducking evasion, counter to counter to, oh, you're going to do that, I'll counter it. Oh, I can see your counter coming, I'll do that. And it ends in the standoff and the stalemate. Professional wrestling and professional wrestlers have been in love with Jerry Lynn versus Rob Van Dam for what? A quarter of a century. Yeah. A quarter of a century. This is the best version of it I've ever seen in my entire life in terms of the intent, in terms of a complete sense of anti-choreography. in terms of the just the rhythm of it. And the best, what you want out of that isn't this obligation. You want to summon this empty, conditioned, Pavlovian, this is wrestling, this is awesome chant. The whole point, and it's been lost because it's cannibalized itself. The whole point of that sequence, right, is to make you think, when they lock up, how good is this going to be? They haven't even done a move, how good are the moves going to be? I felt it in that audience of, this is the best version of this standoff, this stalemate anyone's ever seen. I go on Twitter, because I want to register my orgasmic pleasure throughout the world. I have a quick little look, and everyone's like, this is the best, this is the best. Yeah. I've said it a million times. There is not one thing better as a professional wrestling fan when you know you are going to watch something that's got a good chance to be special, and then within minutes, you know, oh, dear. Like, this had, genuinely, through that sequence alone, the ultimate, strap in, the 5 stars are guaranteed.
Because it's awful when you feel it going wrong, isn't
yes.
it? Yes. Sickening when you're,
yeah.
they're not going to get there.
They're not going to get there. Yeah. That was the Bucks and FTR at All in London, yeah, when it's yes. like, oh, it's taking ages, this. Oh, they're not going to get there. This was the ultimate guaranteed feeling of, oh, it's 5 already, strap in and enjoy it. Especially for an anxious guy like me. But when I say this was too good, when they started to do some incredibly well-crafted cagey wrestling, I was like, oh, get as good as that. Because that promised the world. And then I got the world, like, within 5 more minutes. Another great thing that I love in any kind of art form that I listen to is, like, when you see something or listen to it or read it and you think, that is such an unbelievable idea, that is so simple, how has no one thought of this before? When you just strike literal gold, like, oh, this is great. Mm. How, the jewel, the idea of a capital D, capital R, capital M dream match is you have to convey that these two guys are inseparable, that they are as incredible as one another. I've never seen that idea better applied than with that duel of, we've each got this shot that could knock the other out. Who flinches is the one who loses. But they've done a better job of establishing the Psycho and the Hidden Blade with the duel. Oh, it was absolutely, like, just unbelievably incredible. You've got these ridiculous, someone's going to die here, and I'm kind of enjoying it. I'm sorry, I'm sick. Like, the Tiger suplex on the top rope, any kind of suplex where they're not really in control. I still think the Kreuzwrath at Wrestle Kingdom was better for that purpose. But, like, it's when the arms are trapped. It's like the Snapdragon at Wrestle Kingdom 11. It's like, if this goes wrong, it's like your heart is just in your balls. You're just terrified. And then when they just do it to perfection, it's just a complete thrill. You know what else I loved as well? And this is what I talk about when I talk about AEW. Oh, you're reaching, bro. It's like, first of all, it's art. I can interpret it however I like. Second of all, I believe Danielson in particular is capable of this level of thought. The La Mystica, right. I've seen him do it before, but I feel like there was a context and a purpose behind it here. Will Ospreay had said in a promo, Bryan Danielson likes doing this. He basically accused Bryan Danielson of cosplaying as this internationally honed superstar who's been in the WWE system for as long as he has, and then thought, well, I'll have a little jolly. I'll go to Japan. Tick. I'll wrestle Blue Panther. Check. And the idea is, Will Ospreay quite rightly said, I've done it. I have been the international superstar. You always said you wanted to be. How much did you want to be that international superstar, really? Because if you did, you'd never have gone. Him doing La Mystica, which I know he's done before, like years and years ago, but it's not something he, in the character's mind, feels like he has perfected enough to be able to do it every single match. I thought there was a deliberate bit of self-consciousness of, oh, I'm wrestling the international superstar who thinks he's better than me. Oh, I'll do this because I've just wrestled Mystical recently.
Even retrospectively makes it look like Danielson booked all those trips because he was gotten to by Ospreay.
Yes.
Right, well, I'm not just wrestling me faves. I'll show you. Yeah. Like, when he folds it, I was completely wired by that as well.
I honestly thought
that's why he went and worked those matches, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's like, it's basically, there was a bit of Mox Omega DNA, except this match was much better than anything they did. And in terms of the storytelling and the drama, and the, like, it's one of those things, I'm it's daunting to convey just how great this was. Hopefully you've all seen it and have experienced it for yourself. And if you haven't, just wait till the last ad and then do it after this goddamn podcast. Mm. It's like, it's hard to articulate because you talk about, oh, this near fall was great in this match. You see a near fall in this match, it's just different gravy.
Mm.
It's not 2.99, it's end of the world, oh, he's done for, and then they do it. So you don't want to, you just have to watch it, I think.
Mm.
You cannot articulate this brilliance, because if you say things like, oh, this 2.99 was outrageous and I completely bought it, you could say that about some matches on this show. It was different when these two did it. And I'll tell you what as well, you don't want to reduce something with so much storytelling scope and how much thought went into it and how the drama built and how everyone in that arena just knew they were watching something special. That five-star guarantee after 30 seconds or whatever it was. In terms of actual execution, that Busaiku knee, yes, from the Ozcutter counter, we talk about intent, we talk about flying nothings, we talk about those rubbish clotheslines that they throw because they're going to duck, right? You could slow down and go frame by frame. If you haven't seen it,
there is a slow-mo on X I've seen about this.
Osprey.
Yeah.
They played the replay, and you're thinking, I would have just taken that in, like, InVision, yeah, and that's fine, and yet they slow it down for you to see how good it was.
Osprey goes for the Ozcutter, and Danielson does a Busaiku knee, right? That is something that Osprey would go for, anti-flying nothing, because it's part of his arsenal. Until, what commitment from Osprey? How does he not flinch? People talk about the execution and the agility and the power that he's got. I don't think he gets enough credit. Will Ospreay does not get enough goddamn credit because he's a supernatural entity of a professional wrestler. If you go back through that footage, he doesn't even brace himself knowing that he's going to get a hard shot in a safe space. It's Danielson, right? He's going to get it in a safe space. Doesn't flinch until the very last nanosecond of that attempted Ozcutter. He's getting his arms, he's intending to get the head of Danielson and strike it to the, and spike it to the mat. And then at the second he's about it in his mind, complete the move, he gets a knee to the face. He doesn't flinch. He does every single second of that motion as if he intends to do it. And of course the near fall is incredible because you think, well, if he's not registering that that's about to happen, he's been knocked out. That's how these things work. And then you get the 2.99. There's a slap that Danielson delivers to Ospreay in this match where I'm thinking, well, don't go that hard. You'll concuss him. That's dangerous. And there's one more.
Wobbled him, didn't he? Yeah. I was a bit like, is that? Yeah.
And the selling was unbelievable, but you don't think it's selling in the magic of that moment of suspended disbelief.
Even how quick your brain works, like, that's not the safe space.
Yeah, I know.
Your brain's doing all these things at the same time, including trying to check where on the body. No, he's just, like, sort of rattled him.
And I want to belabor one more point that I've said a few times. The Mega fans hopefully will forgive me for this. Kenny Omega is a god. Kenny Omega, by taking the Tiger Driver 91 on his head, has done a huge service to Will Ospreay in that. There's a picture, if I remember, I will put it under the link to this podcast, of Danielson taking the Tiger Driver. He's f***ing vertical and he's an inch away from the mat. That tuck is unlike nothing you'll ever see. He takes that thing, it almost looks like a flat back if you really try and scrutinize it. Maybe don't, because the magic will lose a little bit. It looks like the Tiger Driver. It isn't. It's the most perfect application and execution of that move. And then you've got a great take on the finish, so it's about time I segue anyway.
Just as the inverse of that, by the way, how quick was the head going back on that Stars Clash counter as well? Because that's all just in a flash.
It was one-armed!
Like in a flash, like 1 second. It's like, I love the Styles Clash, but we all accept a certain degree of cooperation to pull that whole deal off. And it's like, no, I'm going to do this as a flash counter and we're going down. Like, so just, again, execution.
There's a Hurricane Rana counter that led to a 2.99 ad infinitum, as Excalibur would say. That was just pristine.
You could probably debate this. I think the Psyche was the spot of the match in the match of the year. ergo the spot of the year on the show. You know what? I think that's the thing we're going to be talking about at the end of this year, that particular moment. But there were several within this match that those freeze frames. Yeah, just a bit I wanted to add about there. When a match, that five-star feeling after 10 seconds, and you just have the sense that everything is going to go perfect. I've watched this a couple of times back already. The finish, obviously, all the moving parts that need to play out in order for all of the different beats of the story to be told. Like, Don Callis is there on commentary, as is Nigel McGuinness, wanting Ospreay to kill Brian Danielson, but Ospreay just wants to win the match a fair way. He swears blind that he had nothing to do with the attack on Brian, and that's key to all of this. He wants the best Brian Danielson. If you watch that back, Ospreay turns to the fans to gesture for, like, come on, I'm going to hit him with a hidden blade, hit him with it, like, revving everybody up to rev him up. And he, obviously, that device, he's got his back to the situation, so he doesn't see the referee, like, wildly gesticulating for the doctor. We need a doctor right now. If Ospreay's just staring at that, he's kind of a bastard for going for the hidden blade. The second he turns around is the second the referee leans away from Brian, allowing, what, another 1 second of a gap for him to hit that hidden blade. 1 second out, 1 second either way, that's not convincing. You've knackered quite an important story beat here, and you've, like, potentially damaged, not, you've not damaged it, the match wouldn't have been affected, but the match's quality wouldn't have been affected, but the whole thing they were trying to say about Ospreay's character and the impending babyface turn would have been done in by that. And just when everything is going perfect, those things couldn't look any better. Watch that back. Ospreay turns his body as the referee turns away. It is flawed. There's no point where Ospreay does a sort of little... Now, like, there's nothing. There's nobody in the corner of the post, like, that you get in wrestling sometimes. Turn now. You know when, like, a wrestler moves out of the way so you can knee the partner or whatever? None of that. It's just sometimes the universe does you a solid because you've earned it and the way that plays out. And I really like the finish, by the way. I'm not typically a big fan of this, like, this Danielson bit.
He's done it a bit too much.
He has.
I've not liked it at all, really, whenever he's done it until now.
It was weird, right? By knowing in the moment that the... Safely. I ain't taking a goddamn bump in my life. You're taking the Tiger Driver 91 safely. Because I knew he was fine, I was like, oh, it's the work. And, oh, this is more about Ospreay's character. And Ospreay, the good guy, wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have smashed that hidden blade if he'd seen Brian's leg going. And that's what this is about. Mm. It's not about, oh, God, is he okay? We're not sat here in a podcast worrying about Brian Danielson today. Nah. So that's the way I like to see that used.
Also, shout out to Andy Murray, because I'm looking at the image that you sent round that you showed us, you talking about with that.
It's vertical.
But also, Andy Murray pointed out, just when you tweet this image, just look bottom right, Nigel McGuinness, how happy that man is. That
he hasn't even tucked yet.
No.
It looks, for all intents and purposes, like he's going to land on his head, and Nigel McGuinness has given it the yes chance.
I might have got this slightly wrong. Apologies if I've got these commentators mixed up, but I remember the line. It was, he absolutely murdered him with that. And it was like, not murdered him enough, because they were getting up again.
It was
like, more. He's moving.
This is everything it's just completely over-delivered.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. How can you over-deliver on, oh, this is probably going to be one of the best matches ever.
Yeah, this is it.
Can't wait to watch it again tonight. But cannot wait, man.
It's the, yeah, I said this on the news with Andy this
class
morning.
When the wife and kids won't care, innit? It'll be wicked.
Yeah, yeah. Depending on how, I might try and show the kid, the youngin, what real graps is.
But yeah, the anticipation, the pressure going into this match of, like you say, anything goes wrong or it just is, it's 4 3/4 stars and people go,
yeah.
And they just knocked it out of the park. And you know what? Following on from that, fair play, because often, you know, we've said, oh, you know, back in the day they used to be like, oh, put this match there, and then we'll follow it, and we'll get a huge pop because we're the EVPs, we're the Young Bucks, we're the Elite, etc. Young Bucks straight after this.
Oh, God, all the respect in the world. All the respect in the goddamn world. This crowd, and I'm not overstating things, was pronounced clinically deceased. Even on Twitter, everyone was like, I can't believe the standard that Ospreay and Danielson wrestled. And the crowd, they were dead. No coming back from that. This is the, you know, it's the main event. This is like the main event of the best show. This is the only main event, and it's third from last. And you're thinking, well, this is a stupid idea, and it still was, because I would say for 65, maybe even 70% of this match, this crowd was dead.
You know, it's a ladder match. I know it's a cheat code, though.
It should have been a cheat code. So maybe it was a halfway inspired idea. And, you know, it's total bare minimum stuff, but fair play, they didn't send some poor frigging women out to die for once. Maybe you shouldn't get the praise for that, and that's why I'm not going to go full tilt with it. But you think, like, ladder match, the Young Bucks are rejuvenated. Dax Harwood's forehead looked like, you know, that Don Callis gash. I thought, has that happened to him? Has he bladed? What's going on here? The easiest example is a very recent one. FTR versus BCC at Revolution. I can't remember. They followed Danielson Kingston, if I believe.
I think so.
And they couldn't get a reaction until the second half of the match either. Until Dax Harwood runs a goddamn razor, and he's a good bleeder.
Yeah.
What a bloody bleeder he is. And then you get that noise of, ooh, it's that audible, kind of sickened, but completely into it.
My blood is your blood. We're family.
We're family. You get that audible, ooh, the sound of distress and excitement in the exact same breath. I love that sound. Love that sound in a pro wrestling match. They didn't even get that sound when Dax is pissing blood, and you're thinking they've got no chance whatsoever here. No chance. And then they have this, you know, that wonderful Rock quote of when, like, it starts to go awry with the Cody build, and he turns around to Nick Khan, and I love the balls on this, and the arrogance of the Rock here. What if I became the greatest heel of all time? And it's like, oh, okay, you did, and you did it, and it worked, so well done. But, like, what a claim. What a unbelievable. I love how the version of this in AEW was, what if we have the most demented ladder match witnessed in years and years and years. This was absolutely f***ing nuts.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. I usually hate these detached, earnest chants. There is nothing better, Kikuchi, Kobashi, Furnace, LaFon. There is nothing better than just indecipherable, primal cries of just animal emotion that you can't articulate or detach yourself from and then articulate. Maybe it's the modern sensibilities and the reality of it, but please be careful, kind of struck with me. It's like, on their own terms, they're kind of saying, thanks, you probably don't need to, but thank you for going this hard. There's a point where Cash Wheeler takes Matthew Jackson off the apron with that spear. It's like Cash Wheeler, if his sprint or his fall wasn't broken by a table / Matthew Jackson's cranium going against a barricade, which, by the way, he couldn't even protect himself. Most horrific bumps you'll ever see. I loved it. The way Cash Wheeler propels himself out of that ring, what if he did it right on the side of the ropes facing the tunnels? I think he'd fly down one of the tunnels. I think he'd fly down one of those. He cannot. He's an animal. He's a catapult. He's a machine. And then Matthew Jackson got in the way of the bullet and just smashed his head against the guardrail with no give whatsoever. And then fans, even after that, are like, you know what? That was pretty good. You might get my attention here. And then they ultimately, for the last 5 minutes, get this reaction that is impossible. They have performed CPR on a clinically dead crowd by wrestling and doing some of the most unhinged bumps. And the thing is that these fans don't care at this point in the night with their physical fatigue of the bits of connective tissue that put this together and these lovely little touches. They still existed and I enjoyed them. The way they built the EVP trigger on Cash by crotching him onto the ladder, that's Young Bucks thought. That is pure, unfiltered Young Bucks genius. I also loved as well how Cash Wheeler's got that uneven record with the 450. Failed in the first match famously by breaking their own code, nailed it at Wembley, and that's sequentially he's got that mentality with a Nicholas Jackson to say, you know what, I'll show you how it's actually done, you prick. And then he does it through the table and it looks amazing. This match was disgusting, and I thought it was a towering achievement of ultra violence. How did they get this crowd? They didn't even get them for that long. The fact that they got them for 5 minutes puts it over as a towering achievement. What will happen is in about 2 weeks, I might watch this again. In fact, I'm going to watch it again. I'll probably get a little bit sad again. I'm like thinking, please get there with this. What they should do, because the graft here was off the chart, like an unbelievable level of commitment. They should give them Escalera de la Muerte, just as an excuse to run this back in front of a hotter crowd, because my God, they deserved a better reaction. And the fact that they got one in the end is it's a towering achievement.
I think that's it. I think I agree that they deserve a better reaction, but I almost think the better reaction, as we've seen with the Young Bucks and FTR, might never have come. And instead, what they achieved here was almost more impressive. Yeah. I think this is my favourite of the series now over the second one, the Dynamite one, because I was just more not just by the spots, I mean, but I was wowed by the atmosphere they were able to conjure up when they've had more advantages working for them before and not really managed to do this. I think I preferred this. I'd need to watch them both, and it's been a long time. I know it was one of your favourites. I think I preferred this. Again, vibes for the building. To Bucks and Lucha Brothers from
All Out 2019? Oh, in terms of a ladder?
Yeah,
All Out 2019.
Spots. I think I'd favour this one slightly. And again, I just think an element of that.
This is what demented this.
Yeah.
This was insane.
It went more insane. And you're right. There was fans telling them, you don't need to do this. But then with their guttural, visceral reaction saying, keep doing it. It was both, wasn't it? Colliding. Yeah. I think they, like, to the credit of the wrestlers, I think they would have known that. And the Young Bucks especially, I think, masters of this, like, would have measured.
PWG Young Bucks this.
Yeah, would have measured.
How have they gone this hard at this age?
You got 40 guys on your roster that are all going to go and try and go out and top each other, being as crazy or as demented as they can be. And that's in their DNA to just sort of take this on as a fun challenge as much as anything else.
Yeah, fair play to them for following that, because they somehow followed it. And that, again, that's probably more impressive than doing it in front of a fresh audience. We should mention as well,
I was going to say, despite everything they've gone through, Dax is going to win the match for FTR. He's reaching up to grab the belts. He's knocked off one of the Jacksons from the top of the ladder. And then a fan jumps in, mask on, tips the ladder over. He's tackled by security, removes the mask to reveal, of course, as anticipated and hoped for, I think it's fair to say, it's Jack Perry and all the heat.
Anticipated, hoped for, and yet again, illustrating what an achievement this was, I would say for the past 5 minutes of this match, the predictable finish that at some point these fans are waiting for happens, and you don't think about it because you're so in tune with the moment. And Jack Perry's face was absolutely magnificent. Absolutely magnificent. This promotion has needed a top heel. I don't necessarily think it's him. If it can't, like, for now, he's the perfect heel for the moment. I don't know if he's, I don't know if he's a lock to headline as a heel, Double or Nothing 2026. So out like that, try and keep this going for as long as you possibly can.
He's a perfect candidate to join the Elite because he's so not elite. Like, that fits this perfectly. The way that the form that the Bucks and Okada are in, Jack Perry is the, like, the guy that is clearly level below, but is their dickhead mate, I think is a perfect fit in this group. His face, like, you only get one chance to get that right, really. That whole moment is a oneer, isn't it? Like, they're going to pull that mask off, and then it's what exact smug grin do you pull in that moment? He nails it.
It's almost subdued.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing you've ever seen and kind of subdued.
Remember the big brother? It's Jackie.
It's
Jack Perry. It's like an arrogance that, is it like, yeah, you were expecting me, weren't you? Arseholes. I like that sort of, that indignance he's got. Security sold it great as well. Like, genuinely a great visual of, like, he's one of ours.
What do we do?
Good stuff.
Was it a Sting mask?
Yes. Which is never not partner.
Yeah.
Because what if it's Sting?
I know.
And then we get to the main event for the AEW World Championship, Samoa Joe versus Swerve Strickland. He's finally done it, Sige.
He has. And look, again, you have to put over Swerve Strickland. And I've been a little bit cynical about whether or not he's the guy. After this show, to get those reactions, I think the jury's still out, but my God, what a start for him. People wanted him. It didn't feel like, right, okay, we're tired. We know what's happening. We'll get up for the finish. It's the ultimate thing. Everyone pops for a title change. Like, people popped for intercontinental title changes when they happened, when that belt was in the bin. Mm-hmm. Also had the prototype of that hemp belt. but this is more than that. Truthfully, subjectively, I didn't feel a great deal for the match. It's weird. It's like, objectively, if there is such a thing as objectivity in pro wrestling, the whole idea is, well, the crowd loved it. The crowd were really into this mostly through the duration. For me, I thought this was a successful execution of not the best layout. The best part of this match, I thought it peaked early in terms of excitement, is you've got Swerve doing really cool fireworks spectacular stuff against a guy who you have to dust off your best stuff for, and it's Samoa Joe. The Fosbury flop looked unbelievable. Then he ate that sick scoop slam on the concrete, and you're thinking, this is what you need to do. You need to fight from underneath against this guy who's been really well cast and can perform as well as anyone, is a total monster. Then he worked his arm for ages. I thought he should have got his ass kicked. I thought he should have bled. Who cares if Dax Harwood's just bled? Mm. You bled in the build. Excess has never been a problem for AEW audiences, really. We can, you know, pearl clutch about how long these shows go. Maybe it's just Brits nearing 40 being miserable because these Americans watching it at a normal time were up for this match.
Mm. I will say, before I get your thoughts on it, just very quickly, I completely agree with you, Sid, in terms of, I was watching this, and I went into it, and I was like, good, let's go, let's have Swerve win the title.
It's like
and
an adrenaline shot, that tag team match.
Yeah, exactly. And then...
And Swerve's obviously inherent skills and popularity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, got him the reactions that he got.
And I was into it. I don't know whether I was like trying to G myself up, because like you say, if we, you know, you're waking up at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., whatever it is, and watching this and...
1 a.m. I did a split shift.
Fair play. And you're a bit like, oh, God. But I'm going to, come on, no, this is Swerve's time. Come on, let's go. And there was a...
Okay, let's go.
There was a spot where I think it might have been the first Swerve stomp that he hit, where Joe was kind of a
Joe's bit out, no hangman in terms of setting it up.
A bit out of position, and he sort of, yeah, and that kind of took me a little bit out of it. And then Joe kicked out, and I thought, oh, maybe they're not going to do this. Maybe they're going to do a hangman run-in like you talked about, or maybe they're just going to go, no, not this time, and we'll hold it. Osprey is so, like you say, this match has shown, I mean, enjoy holding that title. I love Swerve, but enjoy holding that title for 4 months.
Yeah, keep
brother.
It warm.
So maybe they're going to do that. And then there was a bit where it looked like Joe might get the win, or maybe he was going to, I think it was the Coquina clutch bit. And I went, oh no, don't do this. It'll be a real dampener on this show for me. And I suddenly got back into it, but I don't know what your experience was.
I think I was a bit higher than, see, we talked a little bit about the destiny. I was a little bit higher than Sid on the overall match.
Joe did NXT face on the Muscle Buster as well.
Well, there was a lot of...
Forgot about the Muscle Buster, yeah.
There was a lot of tells that Swerve was going to win. Pretty much from the entrances, and that put me a little bit more at ease with the whole thing. I know I was saying on the preview, I thought Joe might win. I didn't want him to.
No.
I just sort of sensed, like when it's so inevitable that Ospreay wins at Wembley, might they just save Swerve's day for another one? But when it was going on last, when, you know, you had all the embassy lore with the robe that Nana brought out for, like, just to add to Swerve's big night, his entrance anyway.
Yeah.
Like, everything from the moment, like... Ultimately, from the moment the bell rang, you were playing with 1% of doubt that Joe was going to win. And I think, to your point, that's probably where you got it.
Yeah.
Like if he kicks out the finish, oh, maybe that is it then. But I never really had that, and I think I enjoyed the match more as a result. I haven't really, in this over the course of this build, been able to... I've thought most of the time that Swerve's going to win the title at the end of this. I've not really felt it. For the duration of this match, I had a little simmering feeling that this is going to end with Swerve holding the belt off, and it was nice. It was just nice to think that way, and everything I was watching, I wouldn't say I was massively connecting with it as a match. I agree with the usage. I thought it, like, it was either a story beat missing, or they just went down the wrong path and never came out
of it. The whole point is, they did the blood angle, where Joe just murdered him, even though Swerve's had the chain, and the whole story was, I'm pissing blood, you just kicked my ass, I love this, back for more. They do the go-home angle on Dynamite last week where it's like, right, okay, I'm coming out to chin you. You've got the better of me. You're holding the title aloft. I thought the simplest route here was the best. Joe kicks his ass. Joe's the monster. Swerve juices. He prevails against the monster. He took a lot of the match and worked over the arm.
Unless they were told they weren't allowed blood because they'd been blood. Like, there's more rules.
That's Tony Khan. Are you kidding?
Yeah, even
if it's not blood, still.
Yes, I get.
Like, that. Just kill him throughout constantly and then fight from underneath.
Stay down to him. Yeah.
On a night. It's the perfect dynamic and it's the story they told during the build. So I thought that was just a bit incongruous.
There was at least two matches and possibly more, like your mileage may vary, of matches on this card that will not just hold up to granular scrutiny, they'll improve with it.
Yeah.
This is the total opposite. Like, I was watching this, I
would this I crack will, the 250 best AEW matches ever?
No. Like, I will remember the live experience I had watching it throughout, thinking Swerve's winning here, and I cannot wait to see him lift the belt.
That's
a very different, Like, as we sit here analysing the match beat by beat or the like some of the stuff within it, there's not much to grab on other than that. And that feeling's enough, by the way.
Yeah.
I think that feeling was reflective of the building. I think everybody in the building had that for that same reason. But I don't know. It's maybe a little bit swerve as a wrestler as well. I think sometimes he relies too much on some of the stuff that's brought him to the level rather than just trusting that his character is now over enough to take a few extra. I don't always need Swerve's dynamic, exciting, mid-cardy stuff when the stakes are higher.
Brilliant ending to a phenomenal show.
That's the thing. The crowd absolutely loved it. I was happy with the result. I really think that he's got the ability to step up. I just thought they went the wrong route with the match, but everyone in the arena seemed to love it, and the moment mattered more than the content.
Let us know your thoughts on that and everything we've discussed in the comments section below or on X at WhatCultureWWE. Watch there, you can follow all three of us. You can follow Michael Hamflett at
Michael Hamflett.
You can follow Michael Sidgwick at
M Sidgwick.
Follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE and make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts. The three of us will be back on Wednesday, of course, to preview Dynamite and on Thursday to review it as well. But for now, this has been the AEW Dynasty Review. My thanks to Hamflett and Sidgwick. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.